From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the film A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. It's now out on video. The story is set at a bungalow colony in the Catskills in 1969, the summer of Woodstock and the first moonwalk. We'll talk about the movie lives of Hoffman and Goldwyn. Tony Goldwyn is the grandson of movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn. And film critic John Powers reviews the new movie The Insider about the decision at CBS not to broadcast a controversial 60 Minutes interview with a tobacco industry whistleblower. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A federal judge has found that Microsoft Corporation has monopoly power in personal computer operating systems. Today's finding of fact by Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson to apply the monopoly label is not a final ruling, but Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal says the decision is clear recognition of the expansive influence of the software giant.
Microsoft has a monopoly. It has abused that monopoly. And it has harmed consumers, as the judge has found very specifically, in an immediate and easily discernible way.
Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates issued a statement saying his company is still evaluating Judge Jackson's finding. Searchers say they'll work all night, if weather allows, to find two recorders that were on board EgyptAir Flight 990. The Navy says a remote-controlled diving vehicle has come very close to the boxes but has yet to spot them among the debris on the ocean floor. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Investigators hope the recorders will offer information about why the plane went into a steep dive Sunday morning. The flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder might also explain what happened afterward, at least up to the point where they would have stopped. Preliminary radar information suggests that after its initial dive, the plane climbed 8,000 feet. Then it dove again, sliding off to the right before possibly breaking up. It's such an unusual flight path that some experts have questioned the radar information. But the safety board says its experts have checked again, and they stand behind it. Investigators also performed computer simulations of a Boeing 767 flight. They say it appears possible for the plane to make such sudden changes in altitude. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Newport, Rhode Island.
The Senate is debating a bankruptcy reform bill that may become the venue for an effort to raise the minimum wage. Republicans and Democrats are offering competing plans to raise the wage and provide business tax breaks. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Democrats want to boost the $5.15 minimum wage by a dollar over 2 years. Republicans want to stretch the same increase over 3 years. Democrats say they're willing to provide about $10 million in targeted tax breaks to ease the burden on small businesses, but they have yet to produce those cuts. Republicans are backing a package costing more than $18 billion over 5 years. It includes a health care deduction, pension reforms, and a deduction for health insurance for the self-employed. It would also make a welfare-to-work tax credit permanent. Lawmakers say the chances are good that some minimum wage hike will pass the Senate this year. House Republicans, however, pulled back from the issue after a bipartisan effort drew a veto threat and failed to get enough support. That could mean the issue will be dealt with next year. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials up more than 64 points to close at 10,704, and the Nasdaq was up 46 at 3102. This is NPR News. Drug giant Pfizer's share price fell today, indicating that investors remain concerned about the effect of its attempted takeover of Warner Lambert. Its competition in the takeover, American Home Products, is vowing to vigorously fight Pfizer's court challenge. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Pfizer said Thursday that it wanted to merge with New Jersey-based Warner Lambert in a stock swap worth about $82 billion. The offer came just hours after Warner Lambert had announced a formal merger agreement with American Home Products. Within hours, Warner Lambert officials had rejected the second offer, even though it was worth more, saying they believed the company would be better off sticking with its original plans. The rejection of the Pfizer offer sets the stage for the biggest takeover battle in the history of the pharmaceutical industry. Many analysts consider Pfizer a better merger partner than American Home Products, noting that it's a bigger and better managed company. But investors apparently fear the takeover battle will exact a toll on Pfizer, and the company's stock price fell sharply. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Testimony is set to begin Tuesday in the trial of Sean Berry. It'll be the third trial stemming from last year's dragging death of a black man, James Byrd, in Jasper, Texas. Two other men have been sentenced to death. An all-white jury was seated today in their case. Also today, a news producer for CBS was ordered to report to jail. She had been held in contempt for failing to turn over a copy of a transcript of an interview that Dan Rather did with Sean Berry. Labor Secretary Alexis Herman says she does not see inflationary pressures brewing, with word that the unemployment rate dipped to 4.1% last month. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the movie A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. It's just come out on video. Goldwyn is the grandson of movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn. A Walk on the Moon is set at Dr. Fogler's bungalow colony in the Catskills, a place where Jewish working people from New York City come for summer vacations. The year is 1969, the summer of Woodstock and the first moonwalk. Dr. Fogler's is located just a few miles from Woodstock, but in terms of lifestyle, it's another world. Diane Lane plays a mother of two in her early 30s who married young and is yearning to be part of the cultural changes around her. She has an affair with a hippie who sells blouses at the bungalow colony. They even go to Woodstock together. In this scene, her husband, played by Liev Schreiber, has just found out.
Where'd you meet him?
He's a salesman.
Phew! This is great. It's like a Johnny Yoon routine. So is he a traveling salesman?
Sort of.
What's he sell?
Blouses.
Blouses. He's the blouse man. He's screwing the blouse man. Jesus, Pearl. Why don't you screw the dress, man? At least that way you get a whole outfit, you know?
Now, the movie is set in 1969, and it's about this... In a way, it's about a cultural clash between life at this, you know, nuclear family-oriented resort bungalow colony in the Catskills and life in this new kind of counterculture as is typified by Woodstock, and it's set the summer of Woodstock. Where were you both in the summer of 1969? Well, Dustin Hoffman, I mean, this is a big year for you. It was the year of Midnight Cowboy, the year after The Graduate. What was that summer like for you?
I think I was doing a little Big Man, and we were in different locations. We were on a site where the Little Bighorn fight happened in Billings, Montana. We were also in Los Angeles, and we were in Calgary, Canada. And I can't remember which location we were at when Woodstock happened. I do remember that at the conclusion of Little Big Man, I flew to Chicago to catch another great event at that time, was the last week of the Chicago 7 trial. But I missed Woodstock. I was a little old for that. I was 30 when I did the Graduate, and I was too old to be drafted and too old to be in college, and not old enough, not too old enough to partake in a bit of the poppy seed of the day.
Why did you want to go to the Chicago 7 trial?
I heard it was the best show in town, and it was. It would, ironically, the judge's name was Judge Hoffman. I saw him in action, and he really was an actor. He was kind of a diminutive, wizened little guy sitting in a big chair, talking very softly, so everybody had to lean forward to hear every word he said. He knew how to command an audience. And I met Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden and I had been following it for some reason. I was very attracted to it. I was reading the Village Voice that was being sent to me when I was in Canada and Montana, and the Daily News and all that. There was many more New York papers then. And what I was aware of when I was there is that none of the journalists caught one specific reality, which I caught, and that was I was in the men's room. And I saw Abbie Hoffman in there talking really jocularly with the prosecutor. So what'd you do over the weekend? Oh, I did this, I did this. They were all getting something out of it. And then suddenly they would get in front in the courtroom, and the jury and the judge would be brought in, and suddenly they would assume roles of hating each other.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, so you get a lot out of being in the men's room sometimes, huh?
Yeah, and the ladies' room.
Only in Tootsie.
Hopefully.
Tony Goldwyn, what were you up to in 1969, the year your movie set?
Yeah, I was 9 years old, and I was at a summer camp in Oregon, being a 9-year-old. I was very unaware. I mean, I the moon landing was a big deal, and there was no television at the camp I was at. It was pretty rustic, and so I asked. I remember my mother saved me the newspaper, the front pages of the newspapers for me. So that's what I was doing.
Well, Dustin Hoffman, 1968 was the year of The Graduate, and because of that movie, I think you were probably seen in part as a representative of your generation. And I was wondering what that experience was like for you.
You know, I wanted to be honest in those days.
That's all changed now.
Yes, if I had to do it again, I would have learned the art of selling out early, because I was 29 going on 30, and when you mentioned that, I have a fixed memory of being invited to some college, because actually I went from an unemployed actor, actually someone on the unemployment line, to doing The Graduate, and suddenly I'm thrust into stardom, and the next thing I know is I'm supporting McCarthy for president and flying around the country with one of his daughters in a little airplane to all these colleges trying to, get votes for Eugene McCarthy. From an unemployment line to that in a few months. And I remember being in a college somewhere in the country, and the kids kind of having this glaze in their eye of, oh, the new icon has arrived. And I systematically set out to kind of dethrone myself. and I said, guys, I just played a part. I'm an actor, and I'm not your age. I'm 30 years old, and that's just a guy I played, and it really has very little to do with me. And I set off a bit of disappointment, and then I did Midnight Cowboy after that. And to further dispel it, I guess, I had a great desire to be known as an actor. And I think it's all changed now. I mean, in those days, you didn't even admit if you were on a soap opera. I mean, B-movies were really C-movies, and today B-movies are legitimized.
Or A-movies.
Yes, and the A-movies really won't even get done. And no one went to the Academy Awards, the Golden Globes. I think when I showed up as most promising newcomer, I was the only one that showed up there. I mean, that was a time when we may be going back to that now, and slowly. I mean, there was a whole anti-establishment. Now we are so, I think the kids are, embrace the establishment, embrace fashion, embrace making money. And I really wanted to avert the curse of being called a star. I forgot the question.
Oh, about being being seen as a representative of your generation.
Yeah, I just wanted to be this actor. I didn't want to I would have done it differently. I could have been a big star today. I would have taken advantage of it.
What might you have done differently?
Well, I mean, you just, I probably would have done it differently if it had happened today. It just, it wasn't, I wasn't brave. I was just being in vogue. That was, it was the vogue to be anti-establishment. It was the vogue to be pure. I would probably, you know, lie about my age if I could today. First thing I'd do is tell them I was 22 and
the second thing you do is tell them that you were better than they were.
Yes, and follow me.
My guests are Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the new movie A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the movie A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. It just came out on video. The film is set at a bungalow colony in the Catskills in 1969. The Catskill culture was very much a kind of Jewish working class and middle class culture. I know that you're both Jewish, and I'm curious how much Jewishness figured into your backgrounds. Tony Goldwyn, let's start with you. I mean, your grandfather, Samuel Goldwyn, was a Jewish emigre from Poland whose real name was Shmuel Gelbfish.
Right.
He was the son of Hasidic Jews. His father had been a rabbinical student. As a boy, he wore payas, which is the long sideburns that the Orthodox Jews wear. Yiddish was his first language, and then he remade himself in Hollywood. Was there anything left of Jewish background when you were growing up?
No, in a word. It was odd. You know, he was of a group that was really in flight from his roots and wanted to really reinvent himself and be more American than you know, Henry Ford. So we celebrated Christmas. We really had no Jewish upbringing. And I remember going to my grandfather's funeral at 13 years old and being shocked because there was a rabbi suddenly conducting the ceremony. And it just seemed so out of keeping. I mean, I was not raised religious at all. My parents were not religious, but my grandmother was Catholic and very religious, and there was a rabbi who seemed to know my grandfather well, which puzzled me. And over the gravesite, my brothers and my father, and we were standing over the grave, and there my father was reciting the Kaddish over the grave, and it was surreal to me. How that said, I have always felt a real connection with my Jewish roots, I guess. And particularly doing this movie, although the Jewishness of it or the Jewish setting was not really at all part of the appeal other than it was a wonderful, colorful world.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got into it, it was about a group of people who took an alternate path to him. I mean, this is a story about, and the Catskills is the story about Jews who came to New York from Eastern Europe and settled into the Lower East Side and ultimately into Brooklyn and lived a very tough life. And the Catskills, getting to the Catskills, I'm talking about in the 20s, really, was a break from the oppressive heat and poverty of the city. So they would go, you know, flee to the mountains, and it was a kind of, it was a sanctuary. And then it grew and grew and grew into this, into the what we know as the Borscht Belt and this fabulous vacation Mecca. Anyway, I guess you can hear, I got very, I felt very connected suddenly to that world. I felt that I was, in a sense, discovering sort of cousins in a
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really beautiful thing.
Dustin Hoffman, what role did Jewishness have in your family? Were you brought up observing any Jewish customs?
No. My father was a atheist, not a professional atheist, but when you asked him, he just said, kid, it's all... This is, well, tell me the word. It was one of the first and last things he said to me. I remember when I was a little kid, and then when he turned 80, shortly before he died on a walk on the beach, he reiterated it once again. He said, let me tell you something, kid. It's all, for the air, we can say it's all horse pucky. Would be, I guess, the
cleaned up way of putting
yeah.
it.
But so we had no, it was just my brother and myself. We were not bar mitzvahed. We were circumcised, but I'm sure that was just the city. there was a, my mother's mother did live with us, and she spoke Yiddish. And when they didn't want us to understand what they were saying, my mother, my father, and my mother's mother, my grandmother, would speak Yiddish. I was born in 37. The war, Second World War ended in 45. So in a sense, I went through the Holocaust without knowing it was going on. I never got a chance to ask my parents if they consciously kept it from me. I do know that I lived in an atmosphere like Tony, of a family that desperately wanted to make it, to mm-hmm. be successful, to be American. Mm-hmm. And what American meant was don't get stuck with an ethnicity that's going to hold you back. And I'm sure that's the way the Italians felt and the Jews felt. And unfortunately, the blacks, couldn't deny what they were. And sometimes I wish that I would have had some insignia on me, I guess I did. I mean, there was kind of a virulent anti-Semitism in the part of Los Angeles I grew up in. I remember the words "dirty Jew" and "kike," and for a long time, even as an adult, I would get a little a pit in my stomach if someone said, I don't know what about you, Tony, but if someone said, "So what are you?" Mm-hmm. And you know what that and my dialogue was always, "What do you mean? Well, what are you?" And I would say, "What do you mean?" Well, they say, "What's?" If they finally said religion, I would say, "I'm American."
Right.
"No, what religion?" I would keep pretending like I didn't understand what he meant as a child.
That said, when you were early in your career and you were casting for parts, did anyone ever tell you you looked too Jewish for a certain part?
They would never say it in those words. I think it still exists. If you turn on the, maybe not in film as much, but if you turn on the soap operas, the look is still the same. I'm sure Tony has seen it too, in backstage and those newspapers that the actors buy to look for work. They have available types, and it's leading men. Now, that automatically means non-Jewish and non-ethnic. It means white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, in a sense. It means all-American. Leading ladies, same thing. If they wanted someone who looked ethnic, they would say character leading man, character or character juvenile, as opposed to just juvenile, and as opposed to ingenue. Ingenue was not Barbara Streisand. Ingenue is Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't think that's really changed yet.
Well, how much do you feel like you were able to kind of make your own rules in a way, and how much do you feel like you were restricted from certain parts because of your look?
I ran. It was when I was 20 years old, going on 21, I left Los Angeles and just ran to New York. New York meant, to me, the fantasy was, though it didn't pan out that way because I was basically unemployed for 10 years and just waiting on tables, but it meant for me a place where someone could get a job that didn't look like the people on Bonanza, which was being cast in those days. I mean, Mike Nichols, when he cast me in The Graduate, and it was a really courageous thing on his part, and his friends did think he would, really made the most self-destructive move of his life. He called them walking surfboards. And it was these guys who were getting all the work that had blonde hair and blue eyes. In fact, it's the guy at the end of the movie that I think Catherine Ross is supposed to marry. He purposefully hired someone who looked like the actors that got all those roles. I mean, even Tony, who doesn't really look ethnic, somehow is cast as the bad guy, probably, and has been in the past, because he doesn't look enough like the Redford look, or even enough like or even ethnic enough to be the breakthrough leading right. man. You're like in between.
Right.
Okay, villain.
Now, is that something that you have tried to change at all as a producer?
Well, I mean, this is the first thing I've ever... Walk on the Moon is the first movie I've ever produced that I'm not in. And it was an early pleasure in talking with my director. A producer can say that. My director, Tony Goldwyn, his ideas on casting, because he really was not looking to cast in a kind of stereotypical way. And in the past, yes, I asked for Meryl Streep when, you know, at that time they wanted someone from Charlie's Angels. She was unknown. I asked for Kathy Bates, and it was her first film, in a film I did called Straight Time. Bill Murray, I had to beg for to be in Tootsie. He was not considered seriously in those days because he was just doing those meatball movies. And actors know this, I guess, and Tony's an actor. I mean, actors know. I mean, I still hear it. It is amazing in a community, in a so-called artistic community, that there is such a continuing naivete. If you bring a name up to an executive or a director or even a producer, the first thing they say is, oh, no, 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 no. I saw him in this, and I saw him in that. And it's so many times I've said, and I'm sure Tony has experienced it and said it himself, have you met the person? I mean, because this person is really a good actor. Maybe that actor hasn't been used right.
Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn recorded last spring after the release of the film A Walk on the Moon, which they co-produced and Goldwyn directed. It's just come out on video. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn, and John Powers reviews the new film, The Insider, starring Al Pacino and Russell Crowe. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring an interview with Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn, recorded last spring after the release of the film A Walk on the Moon, which they co-produced. It's just come out on video. When we spoke, Hoffman's 1997 film, Wag the Dog, was still reverberating. The film was about presidential aides who stage a phony war just to distract attention from a presidential scandal. In this scene, aides played by Robert De Niro and Anne Heche are trying to convince a famous movie producer, played by Hoffman, to produce and stage the war.
If you never won an Oscar, how would you like an ambassadorship?
An ambassadorship? Yeah. That's my payoff.
Well, you tell me what you want.
Hell, I just do it for the fun of it, for a story to tell.
Oh, no, you couldn't tell anybody.
Oh, hey, listen, I'm just kidding.
No, you couldn't tell anybody.
No, I know. It's just a figure of speech. Well, no, it's a pageant.
It's a pageant, that's what it is.
Country's a war.
It's Miss America and your bird parks.
Why Albania?
Because?
Well, they have to have something we want.
Well, I'm sure they
do. What do we have that they want?
A little freedom.
Well, why would they want that?
A press?
No. Freedom. They wanna destroy the godless Satan of the United. They wanna destroy our way of life. All right? Okay. The president is in China. He is dealing with the dispatch of the B-3 bomber to Albania. Why? Why? Help me.
Well, what do you mean? What he? What that?
Well, all right. Let's see. Geopolitically, if you.
We just found out they have the bomb. We just found out they have the bomb.
That's good.
No, the bomb's not there because they'd have to have a rocket, right? And they are a bunch of wogs. No, cross out. All right, so it's a suitcase bomb.
I didn't even know I said that.
It's a suitcase bomb. You don't need missiles.
You can put a bomb in a suitcase, right?
You know, in Wag the Dog, Dustin Hoffman, you played a Hollywood producer who produces a fake war that's presented to the public as a real war in order to distract the American public's attention from the president's sex scandal.
You're reading this, I can tell.
I am. That's great. I actually wrote that down so I'd get it straight because I sometimes lose track of what I'm saying. That's great that you notice that.
Okay, go ahead.
So, okay. So anyways, when the Clinton sex scandal broke and Clinton started bombing Iraq, people started screaming, Wag the Dog. And then I read that when we started bombing Serb television started showing Wag the Dog over and over again, I guess to try to discredit the Clinton administration.
I think they did that in Iraq.
They did that in Iraq, too. They did that in Iraq, too. Yeah. How did that make you feel?
It's funny. You don't have reactions like I guess other people have. Right after the film came out, when it went, because we made the film thinking we were being satirical, we were accused in a lot of reviews as, oh, come on, that could never happen. And then, you know, what happened in real life, in a sense, made us look somewhat prosaic. And I guess when you're doing it, and even afterwards, you don't have what one would expect. You don't have the reaction that one would expect you to have. You don't say, oh my God, I can't believe this. Other people say it. You kind of just look at it and you say, oh, that's interesting. You don't, because what we were doing had nothing to do with the Clinton administration. I mean, David Mamet wrote the script, Barry Levinson directed it, and the point that, and they worked together on the script, because Barry's also a writer. And what they were really talking about was the media, mm-hmm. And what Marshall McLuhan, you know, said years ago, the brilliant statement, the medium is the message. In other words, it's not what's happened that matters or that counts or that becomes the truth to us, the public. It's how the media interprets what happened that becomes the truth. The truth has no meaning. It goes all the way back to when the Americans won a battle against the Native American Indians, it was a victory. And when the Native American Indians won a battle, it was a massacre. See, it's the way it's from the very beginning of our culture. It is the way it is spun. And with media, one can really spin in a very adept and all-consuming way. So that script was really pointing toward something that had happened before Clinton. It was simply dramatizing satirically what happened. I think Bush was called, what was it, the wimp factor?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a war, and hopefully to remove and erase the wimp factor. Reagan had politically, from his administrative point of view, a terrible embarrassment because the Army bases were not protected. Where was it?
Grenada.
In Beirut. And shortly after that, yes, he invaded Grenada. What never ceases to, I guess where my mind goes is not what do I think or look how close this is. I was just an actor in the film, and I knew that it was the truth. It felt like the truth. The fact that the truth happens again doesn't amaze me that much. It's happened before. What never ceases to amaze me is all these stigmas that get put onto people, and I'm not even saying whether they deserve it or they don't deserve it, but what happens to it? Tony used the word ephemeral before. Saddam Hussein is Hitler. He must be stopped. He has to be eliminated. Suddenly, Hitler is still there. We don't hear the name anymore. What happened to Noriega? That's all you heard. Well, he got put in jail, but then we learned he'd worked for the CIA before that happened. What happened to Gaddafi? I mean, when they took out a couple of blocks of apartment houses, trying to get him, suddenly he's still, but suddenly they don't bear the stigma. It's a new one now. It's Milosevic. And again, I'm sure that all of these people have certain things, unattractive things, to say the least, in common. But this holds until the next one. And I think that's what Wag the Dog was talking about.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but I'm wondering how you felt when you found out that people, that the movie was being shown in Iraq and in Serbia.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think when President Clinton, I mean, I would tell you if it did surprise me. It does. Why it makes sense to me from a dramatic point of view. When Clinton was vacationing in Martha's Vineyard, and before he came out with the statement, I think about the Lewinsky thing, saying that he had he was now going to tell the truth. I think while they were waiting for that statement, all the reporters were in a tent watching Wag the Dog. And when I heard about that, I just said, oh, well, what do you know? That I kind of, that's the reaction. That's a long-winded, I should have just said at the beginning, well, what do you know? Or as Vonnegut said in Slaughterhouse-5 at the end of every chapter, and so it goes.
My guests are Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the new movie, A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. Now, it strikes me that your backgrounds are really very different. Tony Goldwyn comes from one of Hollywood's first families. And Dustin Hoffman, I've read that your father wanted to be a movie producer, but the closest he came was supervising props once at Columbia.
Yes,
and
he would have loved to have been Samuel Goldwyn.
Mm-hmm. But he made his living as a furniture salesman.
Well, by the time I was born, he was no longer working at Columbia. There was a recession, and he got fired with a number of other people. And he went, actually, at Columbia Studios, he was went from just a prop assistant to head of props to head of the set dressing department. He worked on, I mean, I was told this is before I was born, but he worked on Frank Capra films, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He did some of the set dressing for that. And then he was fired, and I was born, and I guess he took his expertise from set dressing to furniture. And I always thought of him as being a successful person all my life, and he did not. I think he thought of himself as not.
And I think your mother once auditioned to be a dancer, but her mother forbade her to take the job when she got it. Do I have that right?
Well, now that my parents have passed on, I guess I have more freedom to talk about, I won't get phone calls from them saying, how could you say that? But there was a skeleton in my closet, which I discovered not too many years ago, and that was my mother had been married before she was married to my father, and she was like 16 or 17, and she ran off with a jazz drummer. And she did want to be a Ziegfeld girl, and she did inspire a lot of Tootsie, the film that I did. And in fact, I was making it when she was ill, and I was hoping that she would survive long enough to see it, which she didn't. But I think I do bear a lot of her genetic heritage. But yes, she was. There's a flapper inside me.
Well, I'm wondering, with your parents both having been or wanting to have been in show business, did you see that world as, like, you know, the gated kingdom that you wanted to get into, but you knew that was going to be really hard to get into?
No, I have an older brother, just the two of us, and he was pushed at being an extra. My mother was very much, I think they were both Hollywood. My father and my mother came to L.A. from Chicago with $50 in the Model A Ford. My father worked as a laborer building the Hollywood Freeway. I have a wonderful photograph of him standing there with a shovel. And I know he loved George Raft and Edward G. Robinson, all these short guys. My father was only 5'2", and he emulated them, and they smoked like they smoked in the movies. I think most of America smoked because of the movie stars smoked. It was a way of trying to look like the stars of the day. And before I was born, because my father was working at Columbia, they put my brother tap dancing lessons, and he was an extra in a couple of those Capra movies, and he so shunned it, he hated it. I think at one recital he fell into the orchestra pit purposefully so he could end his career as an actor. And by the time I was born, they weren't about to repeat that mistake, so I never heard about acting. My father was already a furniture salesman by that point, but they did stick a piano in front of me when I was 5, and I was told I was going to be a pianist. And I grew up in Los Angeles, studying a lot every day, and winding up enrolled at the Los Angeles Conservatory of Music, and trying to do that and be a regular kid, and trying to then break into jazz piano. And I just didn't have the talent. I didn't have an ear for it. I didn't read music easily. I didn't have that facility that we had a little combo that other kids in the combo had, where they could just pick something up. It was laborious for me. And somehow I just took an acting class when I was about 18 or 19, simply to get through junior college, because I was such a bad student. And I never talked about it with Tony, but for the first time, 10 hours passed like it was 10 minutes, just working on a scene with somebody, you know?
Yeah.
This is what I want to be, because there's no work involved. This is not like working.
So you knew you'd found it.
I knew I found what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, strongly believing that I would fail at it. I wish I didn't have such a... I wish that I could have kept my privacy And as a celebrity, you do give that up. You have to measure where you're going and how you're going to go. And when you walk out the door, are you ready? Do you have a pin so someone that asks you for an autograph doesn't have to stand there for 10 minutes asking other people for it? And all these little things that, you know, you put up with in exchange for your stardom, and people videoing you and cameras and everything. And I think, in retrospect, had I known I was going to be a successful actor, I never would have become an actor. I was sure I was going to fail at it. and to fail at being an actor is a kind of romantic life when you're starting out, because it means you're just going to be in a community of actors, and you're going to hang out, you're going to be bohemian for the rest of your life.
On to those ideals.
Yes. And then I thought, well, if this doesn't work, I'll go back to college, get a degree, and worse comes to worse, I'll teach acting at one of those colleges where the acting teacher has a lot of on-campus relationships. Can't be all bad.
That sounds pretty good.
Do you think you're technique-oriented as opposed to intuitive-oriented enough to teach?
Well, I did teach. I taught all through my early 20s. I was living with Bob Duval, and he used to come home from the post office and complain that I had all these chairs, these card table chairs I got from the Salvation Army. I got about 30 of them for $20. And he says, how many times do I have to tell you to clean up the chairs and put them back in the closet? He says, and because I made a classroom out of our living room, and with the coffee cans and the cigarette cans all over the place. But I always enjoyed teaching. I don't think it's difficult to teach well. I think the trick is to not have a method, even though I studied it, is to know that each actor has to find their centered the way, it's not much different than parenting, I don't think. Or directing, I guess Tony can.
It's very, very right. I mean, Dusty is a wonderful teacher. I feel like, to me, in a lot of ways, he helped performed the role of a teacher a lot. And when we were cutting the film and helping to guide me through my creative process, because as he just said, the bad kind of acting teacher is the one who says, "Okay, this is right. This is how you do it. This is the way to do it." And every actor has had those kinds of teachers. And a good teacher is the one who can, like a good director, or lead you to your own instincts and sort of shine a light on where you as an individual need to go. And because ultimately everyone's method is only their own, wouldn't you say?
I think the striking thing in film acting, I don't think there is such a thing as a bad performance that should be laid at the actor's door. I really think it's the director and the editor's responsibility to make sure that there is not bad acting on that screen, because you really can get good performances out of actors mainly by giving them the freedom not to feel they have to make the scene work. And I know this is getting involved, but that's what Tony did. And to let them find another way of getting to it. And another way is always their own way. And their own way means that it hasn't been done before. And many directors don't want to see what has not been done before.
What's the best advice you were ever given for a movie?
Probably Mike Nichols in The Graduate, who told me almost every day two things. Three things. One was, stop acting. Don't do
I thought he meant get a new career. Well, he just meant tone it down, right.
He probably thought that. Uh-huh. But he would say, you're acting, don't act, don't do anything, because you are doing so much in front of a camera by not doing what you think is anything. I mean, you're on whatever it is, 70 feet of screen. You're already interesting. And the audience is doing a lot of the work for you, even. I mean, you don't have to do their work for them. And he said, if I did something he didn't like, he said, what did you do that take? And I would tell him, and he would say, why? And I would tell him the reason. And he would look at me, he says, oh, I get it. Okay, on this next take, when you get an idea in the middle of the scene, do the opposite.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And that was really a smart thing to say. And then the third thing he did five or six times a day was tell me to clean the inside of my nose, which
is actually the most helpful.
Which has kept me on the marquee for
giving you a reason to have that pen in your pocket.
Now, is that important? Hasn't a good take ever been ruined by an embarrassing you-know-what in your nose?
Yes, but now with digital, they can just... it's costly,
really,
but they can take a lot of boogers out that they couldn't do.
Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. They produced the film A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn also directed. It's now out on video. Hoffman is in the new movie, The Messenger, the story of Joan of Arc, which opens next week. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie, The Insider. This is Fresh Air. The Insider is a new movie directed by Michael Mann, starring Al Pacino and Russell Crowe. It's based on the true story of tobacco executive turned whistleblower Jeffrey Wigand and his experiences with the TV show 60 Minutes. John Powers has a review.
By now, you've probably heard about the controversy surrounding The Insider. Some of the real-life people depicted in the movie, such as 60 Minutes anchor Mike Wallace, are complaining that it portrays them unfairly. Meanwhile, director Michael Mann insists that, despite a wee bit of dramatic license, the film is essentially true. As an outsider, I have no way of knowing which side is right. But I do know that The Insider is one of the most engrossing pictures of the year, a tale of two prickly, paranoid men battling corporate betrayal. Al Pacino stars as Lowell Bergman, a veteran producer for 60 Minutes. Digging into a story, he comes across Jeffrey Wigand, played by Russell Crowe. Wigand's a painfully decent, tightly wound scientist who's just been fired from a big Louisville tobacco firm. Bergman thinks he's finally found an insider who can spill all the secrets about big tobacco. And so he quickly starts plying Wigand with idealistic notions about the common weal and promising that his TV show won't burn him.
You go public and 30 million people hear what you gotta say, nothing, I mean nothing, will ever be the same again. You believe that?
No.
You should. Because when you're done, a judgment is going to go down in a court of public opinion, my friend. And that's the power you have.
You believe that?
I believe that. Yes, I believe.
You believe that because you get information out to people, something happens?
Yes.
Maybe that's just what you've been telling yourself all these years to justify having a good job, having status. Maybe for the audience, it's just voyeurism, something to do on a Sunday night. And maybe it won't change a thing. And people like myself, my family, I left hung out to dry, used up, broke, alone.
Are you talking to me, or did somebody else just walk in here? I never
assume any of that. Understand.
No, don't evade a choice you gotta make by questioning my reputation or 60 Minutes with this cheap skepticism.
I have to put my family's welfare on the line here, my friend. And what are you putting up? You're putting up words.
Words.
Guess who's closer to being right? Wigand risks everything to tell his story on 60 Minutes, only to have the program kill the interview for fear of a lawsuit. Such a story is perfect for Michael Mann, a poet of machismo whose taste for outlaw romanticism ran through Miami Vice, The Last of the Mohicans, and Heat. Of his two heroes, Wigand is the movie's emotional center and by far the more fascinating figure, a smart, jumpy, desperately honest man who clings to what's left of his integrity like a barnacle. He's played with Oscar-worthy brilliance by Crowe, the superb Australian actor who's barely recognizable with his new paunch, gray hair, and aviator glasses. As he showed in L.A. Confidential, Crowe has a knack for playing big men with wounded souls who lose their innocence and then seem stunned at what the world is doing to them. Bergman is equally stunned when 60 Minutes double-crosses his source, but his story's hokier because he's so obviously a Hollywood concoction. Passionate, fearless, and absolutely trustworthy, Bergman's a paragon, the last honest man in TV news. Such a character would be insufferable if played by a star like Robert Redford, who always has the self-satisfied gleam of one who knows he's right. Remember Up Close and Personal? In contrast, it's part of Pacino's strange charisma that he seems haunted by everything, even his own righteousness. When things go sour, Pacino's ancient Sicilian eyes pass a more damning judgment on TV news than anything a screenwriter could give him to say. Back in the 80s, Mann was known for his delirious addiction to high styles, from the South Beach pastels of Miami Vice to the noir opera of Crime Story. But over the years, he's refined away some of that meretricious flamboyance to become one of the most hypnotic filmmakers working anywhere. Mann has no superior at evoking pervasive paranoia, or at venturing a surreal touch, like a car burning unattended on the Louisville roadside, that seems like a message from the cosmos. And he populates The Insider with terrific supporting performances, especially the witty turn by Christopher Plummer. Plummer plays Mike Wallace as a man who's infinitely tickled to be such a great man as Mike Wallace. He's not about to risk his career for the Wigand story, telling Bergman, and I quote, "I don't intend to spend the rest of my days wandering in the wilderness of National Public Radio." Well, well, well. The Insider is not without its bombast and portentous moments, but if any subject deserves such a treatment, it's this one. Mann gives us a tale of 90s America, where corporations grow ever more massive, wield ever more control, and take ever more care to suppress information they don't want us to hear. Although this is not a new story, it is the essential story of our time. And no Hollywood movie has told it more compellingly than The Insider, which makes one thing abundantly clear. If you want to tell big truths about the big guys, you'd better button your coat, because you're stepping out alone into the cold.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. That's Joel's band we're listening to now. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Yoga and the Quest for the True Self by Stephen Cope, an exploration of yoga as the path to self-awareness and a tool for emotional healing. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And Crown, publishers of the novella by novelist Stephen Milhauser, Enchanted Night, a tale about the power of the moon, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, TV writer, director, and producer Marshall Herskovitz. With his partner Edward Zwick, Herskovitz created 30-something, My So-Called Life, and the new show Once and Again. Join us for the next Fresh Air.